CS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Joining us on the show today is Robert Shiller. He's a Yale economist, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2013, the author of numerous books, including his latest, which is titled Narrative Economics, How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events. Robert, narrative economics, let's talk about that, and particularly how what you are describing in your book differs from how most economists think about and model the economy.
Well, I think the economics profession is changing, and it's moving this way. So it's not, this book is not entirely original. But on the other hand, I think I have new perspectives. So the problem is economists are asked to forecast. That means predict changes. So what's changing? Well, traditionally, economists would say things like exhaustion of natural resources, technological progress, new acts of Congress, acts of the Federal Reserve. That's the standard thing that comes to mind. But I think that a very important source of economic change is in people's thinking about how the economy works, what I should be doing. And they're not economic theorists. They convey these ideas to each other through narratives, stories, as examples, stories with a moral or an interpretation of events. And I think economists need to study those stories if they're going to really be able to forecast well.
In the past, economists sometimes classified people as so-called homo economicus, where humans were viewed as rational agents that make economically optimal decisions. How does that differ from homo narrativus, which may be a more accurate way to describe how we operate?
Well, yeah, they want to name our species after some salient characteristic that's unique to our species. And I guess it's pretty much agreed that we're the smartest species on the planet. So we could say Homo sapiens. Sapiens means smart. But there's other things that are also distinctive. And one of those is another human universal everywhere, every society. They all have language and they all tell stories. And sometimes they set these stories to music. It's been proposed to call us Homo musicus also because we're the only species that really has music. Maybe songbirds do too, I don't know, but it's mostly human. So it's kind of programmed into our mind. There's not a clear distinction between music and speech because often Homer sung his books that he wrote, and songs today have stories with them. So the thing is that humans, most humans who are not scholarly, or maybe they're very smart, but they're not in the economics tradition. They think in terms of stories. My life is a certain story, and I aspire to a certain kind of life that would be a story that would be remembered. And I interpret in terms of scripts for me, what other people are doing, what their story is. And that involves some economics.
In your book, you show how narrative economics borrows its insights from many different disciplines, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and even religious studies. This is quite different from the mathematical abstracts or heavily model-driven economics of today.
Well, I'm a big admirer of traditional economics, but I think we have to keep moving ahead. There was a kind of a fad among economists for excess mathematics. I mean, it's okay to be a mathematical economist, and it's interesting, but it's not all we need. So the second half of the 20th century was kind of ignoring psychology, sociology, anthropology, history. They just wanted to get into the models. And that was a useful phase, but it's time to move on. And I think the profession is moving on. You know, it's less focused on abstract theorizing now than it was just 10, 20 years ago.
Now, Robert, for those listening that may be thinking that narrative economics sounds like it doesn't have any mathematical or scientific basis to it, that's certainly not true. And a very fascinating theme of your book is how closely narrative economics, especially when we think about how narrative spread from person to person, is related to the field of epidemiology.
Well, actually, a lot of people link these things, but they wouldn't think to go to a medical journal and read mathematical epidemiology. But the phrase going viral is being tossed around a lot. Some people will post something on the web or in a social media, and then it just gets viewed millions of times. And why is that? You know, when you look at some of them are ridiculous. These memes that they're just contagious. I don't know. It's kind of funny, or it's somehow appealing, and so we spread it. We tell others about it. We like it in some cases, or we just talk it up. So in that sense, it's like a disease. It is contagious. Now, the thing is, epidemiologists trying to understand outbreaks of a disease find it inherently puzzling, and they've been working for mathematical epidemiology goes back 100 years. The epidemiologists have to confront the fact that episodes seem to come out of nowhere. What starts an epidemic? Well, the bottom line in the simplest epidemic models is that something affects the contagion rate. You might have a disease that's mostly dormant, not affecting many people. But now suddenly there's a change in the weather or social customs or a mutation in the pathogen, and then it suddenly explodes. It explodes when the contagion rate is higher than the recovery rate, so that more sick people are arriving than are getting better. And it's the same with narratives. A story that is tellable or retweetable or something like that, it has to be retweeted enough to overcome the forgetting. People forget. It's built into our brains to forget things that aren't reinforced. Freeze up memory in your brain. So it does the same dynamics as diseases. And it's just as mysterious. How did this happen? Or how did this politician suddenly appear and be so prominent? It's because of contagion of stories.
So as you said, epidemiology shows us how viruses spread, and medical schools, I'm quoting your book now, have produced not just one model, but many different models that can be applied to how we understand the way in which narratives operate through an economy. This is a central and very fascinating part of your book. But, you know, in many cases, you talk about how these narratives are also self-fulfilling, right? So ascribing causality to, let's say, where the chain of causal events is occurring, whether it's from the economy or the narrative or from the narrative to the economy, there is this recursive feedback loop. So it's not really easy to pin down which is causing which, right?
That is right. And in fact, some of these narratives are even transformations of earlier narratives. The Federal Reserve narrative, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve is modeling after J.P. Morgan, who, remember him? He was like one of the richest men in America. And in 1907, there was a financial panic, and he encouraged bankers to support the markets and prevent bankruptcies. So, we thought we need a new J.P. Morgan. He died in 1913. He wasn't around anymore. So we created our own new J.P. Morgan, who's called Jerome Powell right now.
Going back to this idea that institutions, major institutions that have a very large impact on the economy, have their own narratives. That could be Trump having a narrative. That could be the White House. That could be the Federal Reserve. I want to hearken back to 2005, 2006, because I remember there was regular talk about a housing bubble, Bernanke coming on and saying that he did not think there was a housing bubble. And so the Fed had its own narrative. I know you at the time, I remember seeing you regularly on TV talking about how we're in a housing bubble and saying that there was going to be big problems ahead. So clearly there were two narratives operating. You were giving one narrative, which was true and ended up playing out, and the Fed was giving another narrative, which ended up not being true. But then again, as you point out in your book, the success of a narrative may have nothing to do with how true it is.
Yeah, you can't find out definitively whether it is true or false. Usually, you know, it's something about something that hasn't been measured or has just happening now. So in the case of the years that led to the financial crisis, the so-called Great Recession, there were a lot of narratives about people making money flipping houses, as they described it. In fact, that was a new phrase. It wasn't, you search for it on digitized text and you don't find it before around early 2000s. So suddenly there was a new, it's kind of appealing for someone who wants to get rich and thinks, I don't need any special training. I understand how to fix up a house and put it on the market again for a resale. A lot of people have that skill and they are attracted to this, but it pushes the market up. Now, when home prices get too high, it encourages some adaptations like construction of new ones. And so construction reached near record levels just before the crisis. And then it eventually brought home prices down. But people didn't think that wasn't part of the narrative, the idea that there would be a construction response to the high demand for housing.
Right. And so there was this self-reinforcing effect that we saw where that narrative, as prices were going up, was feeding on itself. It led more people. And so narratives play a very large role in bubbles, not just in their expansion, but in their eventual collapse. And a lot of times, in reading your book, that tipping point, that psychological turning point has to do when the narrative breaks, right? It's not data, right? It's not the statistics that break. It's what's happening in the minds of people.
I think that's right. So I started to see it in the case of the housing bubble. I started to see it around 2005, that people were making jokes about those who were flipping houses, and that they'll be shown to be foolish eventually, that something is going to happen. The housing bubble word became popular. So these are things that are not driven by the Federal Reserve or by acts of Congress. Congress is not averse to spinning narratives too. Like they had around that time, the American Dream Act, I think it was called, which was to subsidize housing. But their ability, see, the problem is that it's not obvious how to start a new narrative and make it work to stimulate the economy. Eventually, it gets tired and people start laughing at it. For example, Herbert Hoover, when he kept saying the prosperity is around the corner in the early Depression, and it just kept getting worse and worse, they start laughing at him. He didn't know what he was talking about. You can't just talk up the economy. Maybe you can sometimes.
Right. That was a really fascinating part of your book where you talk about the propaganda used behind the rise of Hitler and how that was used to try to restore confidence and how successful that propaganda and widely used it was in trying to turn. And that was a narrative. It was largely propaganda driven. The American Dream itself was a turn in the narrative, as you write, from something that was quite different before we saw that in the 1930s, more of a frugality mindset, but then the narrative flipped. And now the American Dream largely became one of consumption. So there's lots of really fascinating examples historically that you go into. But I want to ask you, looking forward now as we wrap things up here, where does technology fit in? And particularly when we think about the contagion rates of narratives, because that's something you talk about again with this idea of borrowing from epidemiology. Where does technology and how do you see things moving forward when we think about the power of narratives and their role in the economy?
Yeah, now it's important to understand that narratives sometimes spread very fast, even thousands of years ago. If people thought something was really important, they would stop someone on the street and tell them. Crowds would form. Speakers would. This would happen in ancient times. But now with modern social media, we have more opportunities for that. You know, it could happen back then. Now it happens all the time. We spend so much time staring at screens of one sort or another. And we have leisure to do that. You don't have to walk to the forum and stand around and find someone to talk to. You have the social media. The social media also enable you to find kindred spirits. So if you have crazy ideas, you can find other people with similar crazy ideas, and you'll support each other, and it'll start to seem like everybody. So it's more polarizing.
That's interesting. So when we think about the role of Twitter, the role of Facebook, the role of distributed media to everyone on all platforms through their cell phones, I mean, I get news stories that ping me through my Apple Watch. The spread of information today is so fast that this has to make, I would think, the impact of narratives much, much more acute in the future and today than it did in the past.
Well, I think that that may be true. It also may be that it's even worse in the beginning, in the first few decades of the social media, until we learn how to be properly skeptical. Some of us are awfully skeptical, right? You don't click on things without stopping to think anymore, because there's a lot of hostile elements in the social media. But I think there were similar effects of other in history when the first newspapers were invented in the early 1600s. We had the tulip mania. right out. It wasn't just newspapers. It was broadsides and pamphlets that must have gotten people excited about tulips. And then with the invention of the telephone, it's not so much the invention, it was the proliferation of telephones in the 1920s. I think that's associated with the bull market of the 20s that led to the 1929 peak.
Robert, as we wrap things up, there's a lot of great insights in your book, and I know we don't have time to cover all of them, but are there any other themes or material that we didn't discuss today that you'd like to leave with our audience?
Well, one theme is that there are perennial narratives that were popular once before and then die away and are mostly forgotten, but they come back because they were already contagious. And they have a potential for contagion if conditions change or if there's some mutation in the narrative. So one such narrative that I emphasize is the narrative about machines replacing jobs. That has much longer history than you'd ever guess. It goes back to ancient times. But it really took off in the 19th century and has had repeated stirs of fear that it generates in people, notably the Great Depression when people thought robots were taking over. People have forgotten that was a big thing. They still remember the narrative, but they didn't know how powerful it was in the 1930s. And we're coming back again on that narrative now with artificial intelligence and driverless cars and pilotless ships and automatic translators and et cetera, et cetera, and the rising inequality. This has people, you know, it should be, you would expect it to be scaring people, but for now, it's not that much. We're distracted by something else, but I think it can come back. That's my worry about the next recession. If there's another recession, it might bring back some older narratives, including the narrative about the 2008 financial crisis. But I think this narrative about being replaced by a machine has an element of fear that is dangerous, and it could cause people to pull back from spending.
That's fascinating. And, you know, as you were talking about that, going back to some of the other questions I was raising, it makes me think about what's going on with some of the political interference that we see with Russia, China, Iran, with social media using, you know, fake news. And it's largely to drive a narrative.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the term fake news, it was popular also, not as popular as today, but it was popular during World War II, because the Nazi regime was faking it. They were telling you that the French are running in terror and surrendering when it wasn't even true. That's a natural thing. They did that by radio. They just let out broadcasts, pretending not to be Nazi party broadcasts, but something French. It's been done before.
Robert, it was a pleasure having you on our show, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
Okay, that sounds good.
As always, we want to hear from you, FS Insider listeners, to give us feedback or any questions that you may have on what we discuss with our guest, Robert Shiller, and his book, Narrative Economics. Feel free to email me at cris@financialsense.com, or you can also leave a message by dialing 1-833-ASK-FSN. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.